Our second reading is Psalm 27 in its entirety. And I actually really like the New Living Translation version of this psalm, which is our Pew Bible. So if you would like to follow along, it is on Pew Bible page 425. I invite you to listen again for what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord is my light and my salvation, so why should I be afraid? The Lord is my fortress, protecting me from danger, so why should I tremble? When evil people come to devour me, when my enemies and foes attack me, they will stumble and fall. Though a mighty army surrounds me, my heart will not be afraid. Even if I am attacked, I will remain confident. The one thing I ask of the Lord, the thing I seek most, is to live in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, delighting in the Lord's perfections and meditating in the Lord's temple. For God will counsel me there when trouble comes. The Lord will hide me in the sanctuary. God will place me out of reach on a high rock. Then I will hold my head high above my enemies who surround me. At God's sanctuary, I will offer sacrifices with shouts of joy, singing and praising the Lord with music. Hear me as I pray, O Lord. Be merciful and answer me. My heart has heard you say, come and talk with me. And my heart responds, Lord, I am coming. Do not turn your back on me. Do not reject your servant in anger. You have always been my helper. Don't leave me now. Don't abandon me, O God of my salvation. Even if my father and mother abandon me, the Lord will hold me close. Teach me how to live, O Lord. Lead me along the right path, for my enemies are waiting for me. Do not let me fall into their hands, for they accuse me of things I've never done, and with every breath, they threaten me with violence. Yet I am confident I will see the Lord's goodness while I am here in the land of the living. Wait patiently for the Lord. Be brave and courageous. Yes, wait patiently for the Lord. Truly, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Well, in case you are joining us for the first time in a while, we are in the middle of a sermon series entitled Do Not Fear. It's a series of sermons on the Bible's most frequent command. And today's sermon is on this psalm, around which really the entire series has been built. Each week, as a community, we sing or we pray or we recite the 27th psalm. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Now, each of these sermons stands on its own. You don't need to have been here last week to understand today's sermon. Though if you were here last week, you may notice that today's theme actually follows quite nicely from last week's gospel story. If you remember, Jesus and his disciples were in a boat crossing over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And for any number of reasons, the other side of the Sea of Galilee was kind of off limits. It was filled with undesirable people, even those who may be considered enemies. But that is where Jesus chooses to take his disciples. Even the great storm will not turn them back. Now, today's psalm is not primarily about enemies. In fact, it is not even primarily about fear. Instead, today we're diving into what some scholars have called a split personality psalm. It's first a psalm of trust, but then based on that trust, the psalmist petitions God for help, for protection, for victory. These are usually two different genres, but here in Psalm 27, they're put together. The psalmist is aware of his enemies. He's aware of those people who threaten his life in one way or another, even if it is not primarily a psalm about them. Psalm 27 is not quite a psalm of vengeance, Those do exist. And they create all kinds of problems for Christian interpreters, but Psalm 27 does at least recognize the presence of enemies. It recognizes the presence of evildoers. It recognizes that there are people who intend, at least in the mind of the psalmist, to do me, to do us harm. Now how, as Christians who have been taught to love our enemies and to pray for, not against, those who persecute us, how are we to read or sing or pray a psalm like this? What does it mean to say we have enemies if our ideal behavior toward them is love and forgiveness? The Christian relationship to enemies, the way that Jesus engages them, seems really to be aimed at eliminating the category from our Rolodex altogether. And yet, in Paul's letter to the Philippians, which we heard read earlier, it doesn't seem like the concept of enemies has disappeared at all. Indeed, Paul refers to those whom he calls enemies of the cross. Who are these enemies of the cross? The theologian Dan Migliori observes that they appear to be self-indulgent, materialistic, and seeking after social approval. You remember hearing Debbie read, "Their God is the belly, and their minds are set on earthly things." For Paul, then, the enemy of the cross is the one who conforms to cultural norms, who is unwilling to resist even those things that clearly cause harm. The enemy of the cross knows nothing of the cruciform life of discipleship and is therefore a threatening alternative to we who actually intend to take up our cross and follow Jesus. The one who may be named enemy is not the one who threatens my life so much as the one who would prevent me from taking the risk of following my crucified Savior all the way to the cross. Kill me? Fine. I believe in the resurrection of the body. Try to convince me to preserve my life and prosperity at the expense of someone else's? Well, now you are not only my enemy, but you are, more importantly, an enemy of the cross of Christ. This seems to be Paul's understanding in Philippians. How does it square with ours, with our understanding of enemies? How does it square with an ancient Jewish understanding of enemies, like we might read in some of these Psalms? I had an enemy once in fourth grade. His name was Grant. Grant had an abnormally large head for an 11-year-old, and I could never understand why my third-grade girlfriend would have dumped me for someone who looked like he had a giant light bulb growing out of his shirt. One day on the playground, Big Head Grant was bragging about his new love life, and just as he was getting ready to run over and ask Natalie to be his girlfriend, I stuck my foot out in front of his. And as Grant's giant head smashed into the dirt, I just smiled, knowing that now he would have to ask Natalie to be his girlfriend through his gigantic tears. I wasn't usually a mean child, but Big Head Grant was my enemy, at least in that moment. He threatened something about my value, about my attractiveness, about my social status. And so I responded almost instinctively by hurting him. It was not the most Christian moment of my fourth grade year, but we do all laugh at the story. We cheer when the bully gets knocked down. I suppose I may have matured a bit in my faith by 2011. I remember I was sitting upstairs at the Brickstore pub in Decatur, Georgia, when the news was released that Osama bin Laden had been killed by a squad of Navy SEALs in Pakistan. Maybe it was because I was in seminary at the time and was immersed day in and day out in the life of Jesus, but for whatever reason, I could not bring myself to cheer with the crowd of happy drinkers. I found myself sad, disgusted even, at the tenor of the news report, at the celebratory response that was all around me. at the fetishizing of death, even if it was the death of a great enemy. It didn't seem right to me. As Christians, what does it mean to say that Osama bin Laden was an enemy? Now, it's undoubtedly a complex question. On the one hand, many of the Psalms can appear to justify our inclination to celebrate his demise. Psalm 137, which comes out of the period of Babylonian exile, imagines with great hopefulness the day that Babylonian children will have their heads bashed against a rock. It is a bit further than we might be willing to go, even with our most hated enemies. And yet there it is in our holy scriptures. And we ask, how can this be in my Bible? To which the ancient Jews might respond, how can you judge our dreams of freedom having never been in the hell out of which we dreamed them? In the midst of great suffering at the hands of an oppressive regime, freedom, life, can most easily be imagined as the reversal of power, as taking revenge. And while Jesus, who was himself a Jew living in occupied territory, while this Jesus is undoubtedly a champion of the cultural reversal of power, he says, the last shall be first and the first shall be last, for instance. Jesus also seems to be absolutely allergic to taking revenge as a means of realizing God's purpose for his life. When Peter pulls out his sword to protect his rabbi from the arresting officers, Jesus rebukes Peter's reliance upon violence and heals his now injured enemy. And the very next day, with his last breaths, Jesus asks forgiveness for those who are quite literally in the process of killing him. It's a far cry from what we might think of as resistance. So we might ask, as we read Psalm 27, how did Jesus read these kinds of psalms? Well, as with many things from the Hebrew Bible, Jesus clung to some parts and he appears to cast aside that which was not helpful. You probably have heard this before. Jesus often is quoted as saying, "You've heard that it was said, but I say to you." You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist an evil person. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. You've heard it said, trust God and defeat your enemies. The psalmist prays that his head might be lifted up above those of his enemies. It's a saying that implies defeat, right? That implies defeating them, that implies gaining victory over them, is a more clear way to say that. And Jesus' head is indeed lifted up above his enemies, who are all around him. On the cross, Jesus is, we believe, victorious over those who we recognize instantly as his enemies. We even have within Christian theology a theory of the cross that is known as Christus Victor, the victory of Christ. But we mustn't ever pretend that Jesus' victory takes any familiar form. The victory of Christ is always paradoxical. It is never triumphant. It is never boastful. It's not even recognizable to we who would equate victory with domination. Christ's victory is one of love over hate. It is one of peace over violence. It is one of cooperation over competition. It is a victory of trust over fear. Do we trust God enough to follow Christ in his love for enemy, in his refusal to take revenge? Simple look at our national response to the killing of bin Laden suggests that as a country, we certainly do not, but the church within this country may be, indeed is called to be, that countercultural body which proclaims that there is another way. Do we trust God enough to take up our cross when our enemies thrust it upon us? Or will we give in to those who Paul names as enemies of the cross, who allow no alternative but to fight back, to take revenge, to take what is mine? I don't know how I answer all of these questions. I don't know how we answer them as a community of faith. But I am convinced that they are the questions that our faith poses to us. And this is that faith, at least for today. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Do not fear. Our next hymn is number 423, Surely It Is God Who Saves Me. I invite you to stand and sing as you are able.